The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football today, title race. Man City were swashbuckling, now just buckling as Man United take the lead. Exciting times in the Premier League. Meanwhile, at Goodison, decayed for David Moyes, decayed for Spurs. As race for third place heats up. And at the bottom, oh Lino, how could you? QPR, ghost goal, hoo-ha, etc. We ran up that. Preview the week's Euro action. Check out Ligue 1, Ibra throwing his headband in Serie A. And hear from Sid in Spain on Thursday's biggie at Old Trafford. Can United make Bielsa blub? Or will the Old Trafford fans be saying Bilbao wow? All that plus post tweets and more in Football Weekly. Hello, everybody, and thanks for joining us on the panel today. Barry Glendinning.
Hello, James. And today I'll be talking about Mark Hughes being wrong and Bayern Munich and Basel.
Exciting. Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you, Jimbo. And today I'll be talking about Mr. Suarez talking to French television and why we ought to give love to Swansea.
All right. And Rob Smythe.
Morning, James. And I'll be talking about that Bilbao wow pun for as long as I live.
Oi! Love for Swansea, that's item one on my agenda. Rob's going to lead us off. I'm going to quote Rob. David has been landing one on Goliath for centuries, but they put a couple of new spins on an old tale. Swansea have spent about 15 million over the last 5 years. City have spent over 500 million. No question which side looked like $1 million on Sunday afternoon.
They were fantastic, weren't they? I mean, as we said before, it's not a surprise that they beat City. David has been a big guy for decades. It's the way they did it, the conviction, the quality of football. And I think in the first 20 minutes, they had something like 69% of possession, which is extraordinary because for most of City's away games this season, they've probably had a lot more than 60% of the ball. They were outpassed and outplayed. It was just such a heartwarming achievement, really.
This was coming, this result.
Well, City's away form has been dodgy for 3 months now. It goes back to the draw at Liverpool. They scored 23 goals in the first 6 away games, won 5 of them. They've scored 4 in the last 8 and have only won 2 of them and have lost 4. Purely in statistical terms, they are doing what Keegan's Newcastle did. They continue to win at home, but their away form is just gone. And if they don't address it, there's no way back.
I mean, one of the most remarkable things about Swansea, apart from the possession, certainly is quite extraordinary, is the fact that what they're doing by exploding every single myth.
Yes.
You know, that has generally been bandied about promoted sides and the way they can do well in the Premier League. And one very interesting statistic for the Manchester City game is that City committed more fouls. And then Swansea, yet again, came out of a game against a top team without any yellow card. So it's absolutely remarkable.
There's almost no precedent for what they're doing. When you think of the disparity of resources in modern football and the nature of the football they play, it's an astonishing conceit to come into the Premier League and say, right, we're going to do it like this. We're not going to change. We're not going to compromise. And to pull it off with a squad that's cost 15 million. It's remarkable. And it's about so much more than results. I mean, they're still only, 14th or whatever in the league, but it's about so much more than that. The fact they beat City just adds a level of glory to it. It's wonderful.
The big worry for Swansea fans, of course, is whether or not they'll be able to hold on to their players.
Yeah,
and their manager.
And their manager. I think it could go either way for them. If the players stay, the players they have, they'll obviously be able to attract better players to what was an unfashionable club, but has been so impressive this season that I would imagine higher profile players will have their heads turned and go, oh yeah, I'd quite fancy playing there, embracing that ethos. But I suspect it's going to go the other way, that bigger clubs will come in and cherry pick Swansea's best players. I did the rumour mill this morning and noticed that already Juventus are sniffing around my mucker Gylfi Sigurdsson. Admittedly, he's only on loan from Hoffenheim, but I'd imagine Swansea fans were probably hoping, you know, that his performances would be low-key enough for him to them to be able to sign him during the window.
I agree with that completely, and that's one of the sad things in modern football. A team can't really stay together too long. But I bet you when most of these players retire, they'll look back and none of them will have had a better time in their career than they're having right now.
You could also say that Swansea's success is not reliant on the presence of big players. Even if there are some players who are very important, you know, Leon Britton, everybody knows he's the metronome of that team. But it is very much a team that is based primarily on what the manager does on the training ground and obviously what he does in terms of man management, because I've never seen them wilt. Even, you know, you remember the first game, I mean, when they lost 4-0 against Manchester City, well, for the best part of an hour, they were doing exactly away from home what they had, what they did to City this weekend.
Well, a 1-0 win this weekend. Correctly.
Hardly conceded as well.
Sorry?
Hardly conceded.
Well, yeah, the Michael Richards equaliser correctly disallowed by the lineswoman, Sean Massey. And they could have had a couple more, couldn't they? Not only that extraordinary moment when Scott Sinclair had a pot. A little bit of love, I think, for Joe Hart as well. What a great character he is, bundling up the other end, looking for the equaliser, screaming back, trying to get that ball when Scott Sinclair fired from about 60 yards. And the penalty, Rob. Tell us about his mind games on the penalty.
Actually, before, what was he actually, was he saying something like, you won't beat me?
No, he was, no, I thought so, but it's been lit red successfully. He's saying, don't wait for me, don't wait for me.
Joe Hart's great, he's obviously a brilliant kid, but he's one of the few City players who looks like he's actually enjoying this title race. A lot of them are looking, starting to look a bit scared. What I like about Hart is whenever they lose, he's very gracious, he makes a point of shaking hands and he like chats to the opponents. It's only a small thing, but he looks like he kind of takes everything, every aspect of football in his stride and he relishes it, and he'll be such an important player for them. I mean, I know their big problem is not scoring, but he's such an important player, because if they start conceding on top of that, then they're in even more trouble.
Which they will do, because with company out of the side, that we all know, I mean, this is a truism, something that's been said many times. With company out, it's bad, and with company and Lescott out, that's very, very bad.
Mm. Well, a lot of the reaction on Monday morning, pretty much handing the title to Man United, who are now, what, a massive 1 point clear with 10 games to go, Rob.
Yeah, it comes down to United have the easier running and a better manager. City have the better players and a better squad, but United also have more experience. The way things are going,
everyone said it was difficult for Man City because they didn't have experience of being on top, and it was easier to chase than command. Well, now they're chasing. Isn't that better for them?
Well, possibly. It's only one aspect. The problem for City is that the momentum's all going one way. They have to reverse it. What they need is a Makeda moment, which United got.
How about Carlos Tevez coming back into the side?
Well, possibly. You know, if Tevez scores a late winner at home to Chelsea, that could be a Makeda moment. Right. If they've got to reverse the momentum, because the way things are going, United's next eight games are very winnable. City have got Arsenal away, Chelsea at home, Norwich away, Stoke away. The way things are going, City are going to go into that derby more than 3 points behind, and then they're in big trouble. However, we've seen before that title races can turn so quickly. Makeda is a great example of that.
Yeah. We shouldn't forget one thing for City, that yes, they haven't been as good of late as they were at the beginning of the season, but before they had this reverse against Sporting Lisbon, if I'm not mistaken, they had six wins on the trot. So they were still able to... I might be wrong. I don't think I'm wrong.
I think that's correct.
Six wins on the trot, which for a team that's not functioning properly isn't too bad.
No, indeed not. They have another game.
Well, the home form is still fine. They won 14 out of 14, so they can almost rely on that. It's just the away form is alarming, the extent to which it's declined.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you see on Match of the Day 2 last night when Swansea scored, the camera cut to a City fan in the crowd? Yeah. And it was like one of those end-of-season moments where a team's been relegated and this guy who's blubbering, you know. Now, possibly he'd had some bad family news through on his mobile or something, or else it had the world's largest bet ever on City to win the game. But I thought, come on, a bit of perspective, please, sir. If you're getting that upset over being a goal down against Swansea.
Perspective indeed. You mentioned Sporting Lisbon, of course, the return leg of that coming up at the Etihad this Thursday. I don't know how much importance, given the situation in the title race, they'll be attaching to this, but they do run the risk. The only silverware they'll have this season will be the stuff that David has hanging in his locker, Budum Tish. Because
if I were Mancini, I'd throw the game. I'd play Hargreaves, all the reserves. I couldn't care less about the Europa League. This is the first all-Manchester title race for 44 years. That is all-consuming. If City don't win the league and they win the Europa League, they're going to look at that medal. This will still be their most traumatic season ever if they blow this league.
I disagree entirely. I think they've absolutely got to beat Sporting, that it is the one thing they can use as a springboard.
Winning is a habit.
Yes, it's a very good habit indeed. And Sporting is a team that does generally pretty badly away from home, be it in the Portuguese League or in the Europa League.
Yeah, one away win in Europe this season.
Mm-hmm. That's not much. And, you know, 1-0, one goal deficit, easily, they can easily overcome that. Teams which tend to forget about the Europa League, I mean, okay, mutatis mutandi, all things being changed to what they should be. I remember the effect that Aston Villa's elimination by, was it Spartak Moscow or CSKA in the Europa League had on their league form. They completely collapsed after that because they were sustaining a form, you know, a run of form, and suddenly he played a shadow side.
Bolton. There's another one, isn't
there? Yeah, there you go. You can find examples like that, and it generally has an impact on the league form.
That's coming up on Thursday. It was such a busy week. Such a busy week. You've got Champions League. You've also got, of course, Arsenal-Newcastle Monday night, but the Merseyside derby on Tuesday, a Merseyside derby which sees Liverpool coming in pretty rank form, and Everton on the back of a fine victory at home to Spurs, which we're going to be talking about after this. Now, Everton Spurs, big game on Saturday. Barry, you were still 38 in those days.
I was, yeah. That's my age, by the way, not my IQ.
No need to clear that one up, Barry, but happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, Everton Spurs. What did you make of that then?
It wasn't a particularly good game, but another defeat for Spurs. They deserve to lose. That's, what, 3 Premier League games in a row they've lost now? Yep. And the wheels are coming off for poor old Harry, which, you know, we've discussed this day last week, I think. But hats off to Everton. It gives them a brilliant platform to beat Liverpool on Tuesday night and go ahead of them in the table and consign Liverpool to 8th position. And their form is deeply worrying for the fans, you know.
Absolutely. The Spurs fans singing Gareth Bale, he plays on the left, as a little reminder to their manager in the game. Debaser92 posting and saying, would anyone like to be brave, put their head above the parapet and notice how Harry Redknapp seems more often than not falter towards the end of a season? Happened last year, happened at Pompey when they won the FA Cup, and it's happening again this year. Just not a big enough squad? Or, as somebody was pointing out today, is it when your big players are out that it's especially important to make your other big players play in their right position?
I think Spurs have a decent squad. Redknapp doesn't like to rotate very much, or certainly his front six anyway, or hasn't at Spurs. And maybe the fact he's had to do that because of injuries to Van der Vaart and Lennon, suspension of Parker, maybe that hasn't helped. They did have quite a good rhythm earlier in the season with a very set front six. Modric, Parker, Bale, Lennon, Van der Vaart and Adebayor. But I don't know. I mean, the other thing about Spurs is they played fairly well in the last 2 games. You said they deserved to lose, but I only saw highlights and I know Redknapp
He thought Sunderland did all the football in the time we're derby, so.
I know Redknapp.
And the statistics would back that up.
Anyway.
No. Just one thing I thought was rather peculiar was Redknapp's decision to play Modric on the left for the duration.
Incomprehensible.
Of the game.
Incomprehensible. And it's not the first time recently that we've had some incomprehensible decisions by Redknapp. And the double substitution at the Emirates was basically suicidal. But the one thing I'm making a comparison with is what happened to Bordeaux when Laurent Blanc became the favourite candidate to succeed Raymond Domenech at the head of Les Bleus in France. Suddenly his team Bordeaux, which had been doing very, very well, as soon as it was known that he was the number one favourite, the wheels started coming off and they finished, you know, they were top of the league and they lost 6 or 7 places in a very, very short space of time. Never recovered from that and had a terrible season after that. So, I mean, the whole talk about England is certainly having a destabilizing effect on both the manager and the squad. And when people talk about injuries, I think that's nonsense. If you compare the injury problems that clubs like Manchester United or Arsenal have had to those of Tottenham's, Tottenham is a joke.
Yeah, I want to speak some nonsense at you then, Philippe. I know there is this truism that if the manager is leaving, or if there's even a notion that he might leave, and we don't know what he's going to do, it doesn't seem by any means certain that he's going to go to England, then that's going to allow all the players to basically take the rest of the season off because they've got a ready-made excuse. But I'm not sure I quite buy into that on every occasion, and it is true that there are key injuries for Spurs. We had, I think it was Simon Burnton making the point about Lennon, the fact not always the most effective player, but what he does, the threat of what he can do with his pace, effectively forces Spurs opponents to approach the game in a different way. Bale being out on the right because there was nobody else to play there, and Dawson being missing at the back with Ledley King now running out of steam at the back. These are all things that do have a major
impact. Manchester United have been playing without Nemanja Vidic, who is
they have a better squad.
Key player. Okay, we were. That is exactly what we were talking about.
That's what I said. Do they have a bad squad? So Spurs don't have the squad to cover these absences.
They don't have a bad squad. They've got a good squad with a terrific first 11.
Yeah. Okay.
They don't have a league-winning squad. That's okay, what cool. we can say.
So do they have a bit of a headache now about even staying in the top four, or am I being overdramatic?
Yes. No, I think you're absolutely right.
Chelsea are trying again. Arsenal are obviously not far behind Spurs. And also there'll be a sense of fatalism now that if the best Spurs team in 25 years can't finish above the worst Arsenal team for 15, or potentially the worst Arsenal team for 15 years, then they have a huge problem.
This said, we've got to be careful in one respect. If you look at the schedule that Spurs have got until the end of the season, they've gone through the most difficult now. It was really terrible. The end of February, beginning of March, they were really tough games in any case. And if you look at their program over the next 6 or 7 or 8 weeks, they should be able to pick up quite a few points. It's more a question of dynamic, and you feel that there could be a dynamic in place at Chelsea. We'll see. Well, the game against Napoli is going to be absolutely crucial for that. Mm-hmm. And certainly at Arsenal, you feel that there is something happening.
Well, if Arsenal win this evening against Newcastle, they'll be 1 point behind. Chelsea are 4 points behind, with 10 games to go. Chelsea, they beat Stoke, not in particularly impressive fashion. They are the Premier League's last hope for a quarter finalist in the Champions League. They are taking on Napoli on Wednesday. The good news, you remember how badly Napoli defended at the San Paolo. Well, the good news is they conceded another 3 goals to rubbish old Cagliari on Friday night in Serie A. The bad news being that they also scored 6. Yeah. And that was without Edison Cavani. And who else was that? Maggio was being rested and Gemayli was suspended for the game. But they absolutely tore Cagliari apart in a game which had some serious repercussions for the Sardinians. We can talk about that a bit later on, eh? You're looking forward to this game, Barry?
I am, yeah. I very much enjoyed the first leg. Chelsea have won none of their last 5 home knockout matches in this tournament.
Really?
And have failed in all 3 of their attempts to overhaul a first leg away deficit of 2 or more goals.
Double whammy.
So the omens are not particularly good for them. And just to further riff on their pain in this attack of stattery, Napoli have won all 4 ties when they won by 2 goals or more in the first leg.
Right, they've always scored away from home this season as well. And they drew out the Etihad, which is not an easy place to do that.
Well, I mean, if going by the first leg and going by what we've seen of Napoli this season, and you tell me that they won 6-3 at the weekend or on Friday night, it's very difficult to imagine they won't score at Stamford Bridge.
Except John Terry's back.
Ah, right.
Well, game-changing John Terry is back. But, you know, in all seriousness, that it's certainly a major upgrade for a Chelsea backline that previously featured Cahill and Louise.
I'm still reeling from Baz's attack of stats. Yeah. How have you been spending your weekend? it's hard to see Napoli not scoring. The other issue with Chelsea is Sturridge hasn't played either game under Di Matteo. Now, I don't know whether he's just resting him or how he's going to play. You would think he'd be an important player. So I don't quite know how Chelsea are going to line up.
You also tried to rest Mata, so I don't think we can read too much into that.
There's 4 Champions League second legs this weekend. They're all poised very nicely, so it should be a great week of European football.
We'll be touching on, I think, all 4 of those. Well, we've done 1 already. The other 3 of those very shortly. But let's just have a quick look at the Merseyside derby. Now, we talked a little bit about Everton and their success on Tuesday when Everton faced Liverpool. What kind of Liverpool will they be facing? A Liverpool side that's lost how many in a row now? Is it 4? 3?
A Liverpool side that have picked up 5 points in the Premier League this year, this calendar year.
Wow.
And they were atrocious against Sunderland, and a seriously understrength Sunderland, because they were missing midfield thug Lee Cattermole.
And Sessegnon.
And Kieran Richardson were 3 of their consistently.
What happened to Kieran Richardson?
I think he was injured.
Oh, okay.
And the other 2 were suspended. But Liverpool were awful. Their midfield was dire. Charlie Adam apparently put in a comically inept performance, even by his own recent low standards, just giving away foul after foul. His passes were going all over the place. And the most worrying thing about it, you know, you'd forgive anyone a bad day at the office, but he just doesn't seem to care very much. He just shrugs it all off each mishap. And I think if Liverpool were playing this badly under anyone except Kenny Dalglish, the fans would definitely be calling for the manager's head. But he has so much goodwill in the bank that I think they're reluctant to do so.
The last 20 games of Kenny Dalglish in the league have yielded exactly 1 point more than the 20 games Roy Hodgson was in charge at Liverpool.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't it?
And Roy's closing in on them as well. They're already about 4 or 5 points behind.
Is that so?
Yeah,
I think so. And Is that pain going to continue, do you think, on Tuesday?
It's very difficult to tell. A derby game is always something you have to take in its own context. It's a bit like, you know, Lazio Roma. You can never make a prediction of what's going to happen.
And particularly this derby game, because I think there's more red cards than any other fixture in the Premier League. It's usually,
and fewer goals, probably.
Probably. It's usually an awful game. It's probably the kind of game Liverpool need, actually.
All right.
Just a kind of grubby slugfest. Get the fans on their side and forget about playing football.
Grubby slugfest. All right, then. Now, down at the bottom... Very exciting weekend. Of course, four of the bottom five are going head-to-head. Net result was that when we had five teams within 2 points, we've now got four teams within 2 points, and one of them, Blackburn, are now three clear of the drop.
And the fans were singing Keane's name at the end of the game.
Were they? What else were they singing in conjunction with his name? Good things this time.
Good things.
All right. Junior Hoylett sends Wolves down the toilet. That would be my headline for that game. He had a great performance, a great match, didn't he? And Wigan drew at Norwich. So they're still bottom, but they're just 2 points.
They should have won that game easily. They were very profligate in front of goal, missed a lot of easy chances. And that was very much 2 points dropped rather than one gained for them.
Is the relegation battle Wolves and two more?
Well, I don't know. I think it's Wigan, QPR and one more.
Do you think so?
Definitely. I think QPR are doomed. Their running is horrific. They're playing badly. Mark Hughes seems to have had no impact on them whatsoever. He, over the weekend, was deflecting attention away from his own poor performances by accusing
the
FA
harsh,
of deflecting attention away from the match officials' poor performances in the game.
All right, well, first off, it was a really poor performance because QPR did score what would have been the opener, no?
Yes, indeed.
The linesman didn't see it, and as a result... They ended up
the linesman made a very clear sign that his view was obscured by two players when Clint Hill, you know, headed the ball.
What was he supposed to do?
What is he supposed to do?
Be in a position where his view's not obscured.
Well, if it happens that he's that there are players which are between him and a very confusing situation. You know, easy on them.
And if only there was an official with a television standing
somewhere nearby. That's one thing actually that really is making me so angry because everybody's talking about this goal line technology. We don't need goal line technology. Nope. We just need cameras. It says why?
Well, you've got a camera.
Experiment. No, but they're experimenting with Hawkeye.
Oh, yeah.
And they're experimenting with this Danish ball which has got this microchip.
Ooh.
And what about the solution, which is TV cameras? We've already got them.
Yeah.
Every single debatable goal we've had. And, you know, we've had plenty. We've had the Carlos Vela. In the Real Sociedad game. We've got Sule Muntari.
Muntari's goal,
So that's three times in 3 weeks.
Yep.
And on the three occasions, the cameras showed the truth. No need to go to this bloody technology. We have it.
Exactly. We have other technology.
Well, I don't think there should be goal line technology.
Oh, really? You think it's all part of the rich tapestry of the game?
Exactly.
Right.
It gives people something
Tell that
to complain about.
QPR fans.
Anyway, QPR fans have nothing to complain about because they subsequently scored a goal that should have been disallowed for offside. So the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
All right, then.
I mean,
to clarify, Mark Hughes was aiming his ire at the wrong people because the FA don't provide referees and linesmen for Premier League games. It's a crowd called the Professional Game Match Officials.
Are you planning to go out in Shepherd's Bush in the next few months, Vaz?
I think Mark Hughes should get his own house in order before criticising other
the
people.
The nature
for
he
doing
said we must demand
job.
Better refereeing. He's, well, the ref maybe the ref should demand that his players can control a ball and pass it and so on. The tone of it was a bit out of order, I agree.
Bolton previously had the worst home record in the top four divisions. Did you know that? Anyway,
that's one for
there
pass.
You go. And 10 games left for Hughes to salvage what is left of QPR's season, and 10 games in which they have to face all the top five. Yikes. Having said that, I still think it's Wolves plus two because of the poor Terry Connor.
If I can add just to the love for Mark Hughes, when he took over from Warnock, QPR had been in the relegation zone one round of the league. That was the first one. They'd never had been in the relegation zone under Warnock after the first round of games. Well, now they're in it.
Okay. Now, I did keep mentioning Wolves. I was going to come on to a whole Wolves manager thing.
Having spent an awful lot of money that Warnock wasn't given to spend.
But that's true. The thing about Terry Connor is, you were mentioning before the fact that 15 and 20, the extraordinary situation this weekend that Cagliari fired the manager, brought back the man who they fired to bring in that man. Mm-hmm. And this kind of happens all the time. And 15 changes in Serie A, and this is a 20-team division, so that's not bad going. but the point is that most of those changes tend to happen at the same clubs, places like Palermo or Cagliari, where they fire a bloke, bring in a replacement, decide they got it wrong, move back. Sometimes I wonder, when you see something like the situation at Wolves, whether in actual fact that's not maybe a model that should be exported. You know, would Wolves, if it were the done thing in this country as well, would they not go, yeah, we might have actually made a bit of a mistake. Mick, would you mind coming back and sorting us out?
It's funny you say that, actually, because it actually crossed my mind on the just idly musing about nothing in particular on the way into work. And I sort of thought, yeah, Mick McCarthy going back to Wolves might be a good idea.
Yeah. Well, is he not still on their books or not? Because that's how it works in Italy. You just keep paying the manager. So effectively, he's on gardening leave. And then if you want to bring him back, you can.
Yes.
But that's not how it works with the Wolves. They've paid him off and he's gone his own way.
I don't know, but Harry Connor looks hopelessly out of his depth.
Mm.
It's difficult to imagine they could do any worse under by bringing Mick McCarthy back. Would he go? Possibly. I don't think he's the kind of guy who'd, you know, take it as an insult if he was asked to go back. If they went to him and said, look, we've made a terrible mistake.
But you don't think his nose would be sufficiently out of joint to...
All this to lead to that.
No. anyway, we'll have more on Serie A later on. But now I think Sid Lowe in Spain awaits to talk about Bilbao and so much more. Well, part three gets underway with a special birthday treat for Barry. It's Sid Lowe on a working phone line. Sid!
Is it Barry's birthday?
It is Barry's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Barry.
Yeah. Sing it, Sid. Sing it. The whole song.
In Spanish.
In Spanish. Funnily enough, the song in Spanish is exactly the same as in English, apart from the words. The tune's the same. So it's cumpleaños feliz, cumpleaños feliz, te deseamos todos, cumpleaños feliz.
Yeah. Do you know, in fact, I think all variants of Happy Birthday to You use the same line repeated again and again, except the Portuguese one. How continental am I?
That's pretty good, James. What I don't know, I'm thinking about it, I'm trying to work out what Spanish is for squashed tomatoes and stew.
Oh, I bet they know that down in Bunyol near Valencia.
Yeah, they would know that. Yeah, they probably would, yeah.
Thanks for that, by the way, Sid. I have this image of you now pouting and wearing a nice Marilyn Monroe-esque dress as you sang that.
And no knickers, of course.
Oh, well. You have to lower the tone.
If only this was a vodcast. Anyway, Sid, listen. Hey, tell you what. We were all amazed here at that Spanish side that turned up at Old Trafford last Thursday. They were the Athletic Bilbao. How come you never did any interviews with them?
Oh, you bastard.
No, but they were terrific. What was the reaction like in Spain to that?
Excitement more than anything else. I think one of the things that, I was actually asking this the other day because there was a story in one of the Spanish papers saying that Manchester United's players had refused to swap shirts after the game. And the reason why I was so interested in this was because having spoken to those Athletic Bilbao players, albeit then lost their interviews, one of the things that was so striking about the whole build-up to the game was a kind of almost a childish sense of enthusiasm. Wow, we're going to Old Trafford. Wow, we're going to see people like Ryan Giggs. And I think that was what made me feel afterwards if United had refused to swap shirts. And some people have said apparently Ferguson doesn't much like his players swapping shirts. But it's a real pity because the enthusiasm was huge. And so afterwards, that kind of fed into the reaction. The reaction was one of, oh my God, they went to Old Trafford and Man United, and they beat Man United and didn't just beat them, but completely destroyed them. And so to say that the reaction was one of excitement and almost disbelief more than anything else. That's not to say that nobody expected Athletic to play well, because of course Athletic Bilbao have been playing well for most of the season in Spain, but it was definitely their best performance. I mean, it was definitely better than I've seen them in Spain so far this season. And also I think once the kind of initial excitement died down, there are one or two people who sort of pointed the finger at United and said, well, are they actually that good?
Well, very good question. Bilbao had a disappointing result at the weekend, 2-1 against Osasuna, so they dropped out of the top four. What kind of game awaits United, good or otherwise, at San Mamés? Is that how you say it, first of all? And is it a very atmospheric...
San Mamés, yeah. They call it the cathedral in Spain. It's a place of worship. And let's not get onto the whole football as religion thing, because I think football is like religion in lots of ways, but not in a good way. Everyone seems to think that football as religion is a good thing. I think it's like religion in some of the shitty things, but there you go, that's another issue. It's a great stadium. In theory, at least, what awaits Manchester United is something relatively similar to the first leg. Athletic Bilbao, a side who play with real intensity, very, very high up the pitch. They try and push people right up. They keep the ball reasonably well, but they're very direct with it. And direct doesn't mean long ball up the pitch. It means everyone pushing forward, always having two or three men ahead of the ball in passing options, if of course it's possible, because it's not always possible. And the stadium is, every Spaniard I've ever met has said to me at least once, Saint Mamès, that's like an English ground. And I suppose there's an element of truth to that. It's very close to the pitch. It's the oldest stadium in the country.
Weather's rubbish.
It's quite steep. It's quite crumbling. And it creates fantastic atmosphere.
Oh, magnificent. So who do you think's going through? So what's your prediction on that?
I don't know.
All right. Barry's got a question.
Well, Sid, I was just going to ask, if Athletic Bilbao play at such a high intensity, and I suspect that may be why they lost against Osasuna at the weekend, having put in so much effort against United, could this ultimately be their undoing in their attempts to get a Champions League place, say?
I'm glad you asked that, because this is the question it's one of the questions that I asked those three players who then disappeared. And that is that, can you keep this up, not least because they played all the way through January in the Copa del Rey. They're playing in the Europa League now, and I would argue that Europa League physically and emotionally takes as much out of you, probably more, in fact, than the Champions League. You tend to have to travel to more difficult places to go. It's not as well organised. It's Thursday rather than Wednesday, and so on and so forth. They play really, really intense, and they, generally speaking, don't rotate. When they've rotated, it's been enforced upon them. And this weekend, for example, they started without Javi Martinez, without Ander Herrera, without Fernando Llorente. Not so much to rest them ready for the Manchester United game, although, of course, there's an element of that, but because they were just very, very tired. And I asked a couple of the players about this last week, and one of them, Antonio Daol, actually said, yeah, that's the question we're all asking ourselves. We don't know if at some stage this may catch up with us. We feel okay now. We feel good. We feel strong. And that some of the physical demands of this approach are minimised by the fact that the work is so well structured. So when they chase people down, they chase people in packs, and it's well organised. It's not just players running around headlessly. It's not the Forrest Gump that David Beckham was at Real Madrid, and that famous quote of him single-handedly running around after people. No, it's done in little packs. And that, at least in theory, minimises the impact of that. But it is a question that some of the players are privately asking themselves, or not so privately asking themselves, saying, I wonder if, worry if this may at some stage catch up with us.
Mm. Now, also from the Liga in Europe this week, of course, in the Champions League, it's Real Madrid, CSKA Moscow, 1-1 from the first leg in Moscow. Plenty of people posting in after Messi's performance last week with comments like this one from the man from Nantucket. I bet Ronaldo has blimmin' loads of shots this week.
Well, he has blimmin' loads of shots most weeks.
Well, that's true.
And when you look at the statistics, it's actually in La Liga this year, I think I'm right in saying that Messi has had more, but you look at the Champions League statistics over the last 3 or 4 years, and Ronaldo has consistently topped the number of shots, if not actually the number of goals. Although, of course, the fact that he scores so many goals partly comes through the relentlessness of his desire to keep on shooting and sometimes shoot from pretty crazy angles. I think there will be an element of that, but I think, you know, Ronaldo would probably not be worrying too much about the top scorer award in the Champions League this year, because Messi's already got, I think I'm right in saying, 6-goal lead on him, maybe even a 7-goal lead on him.
Jose Mourinho staying now?
No, this story run by the Mail, it's a pity that they run a story based on a quote that he didn't say, isn't it? But hey-ho.
All right. Probably lost their interview and made something up. Anyway. All right. Okay.
Well, it was a press conference. That's the most ridiculous thing about it. They make up a quote from a press conference. There's quite a lot of people sitting in that room who've heard him and didn't hear him say that. So maybe they've just got especially good hearing.
All right, then. Anything else we should know about the Liga, Sid? Oh, Philippe's got a question for you.
Something I noticed, I read this morning, and I think it hasn't been noticed in many places, is the fact that Real Madrid are scoring 3.38 goals per game, which means they're on course to become the most prolific side in the history of the five major leagues since World War II, which is quite an exceptional achievement, really.
For a Mourinho team as well.
Yeah, and that's precisely what I was hinting at.
Oh, right, okay.
It certainly is. And in Spain, of course, the talk, I must admit, I didn't know that stat. It's a great stat. In Spain, the talk is about the 107 goals scored in 89-90 when they were managed by John Toshack, and they scored 107 that season. And my favourite stat about that season is that Hugo Sanchez scored 38 goals that year. See if you can guess how many touches it took him to score those 38 goals.
45.
38.
No. What?
Every single goal he scored was one touch. Didn't control a ball once in any of
those.
No,
but he had other touches when he didn't score, presumably.
Of course. Yeah,
well, I know. That's what that seemed to suggest to me.
That's an astonishing.
Okay, right, yeah, sorry. I wasn't saying that in the entire season he only touched the ball 38 times.
That would be
so. I meant to say that in those 38 goals took him 38 touches.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Astounding. And came in about 33 games, I think.
Sid, that was a terrific and exceptionally high fidelity performance from you this week. So thanks very much. Look forward to catching up with you on Thursday, which, of course, will be before the Bilbao game, disappointingly. But let's speak anyway.
Okay, and what I'll do is for Thursday, I'll do what Blackadder did with that piece of paper and make some noise by the phone to make it crackly.
Ah, yeah.
You can get back to the old style
the
phone
warm,
line with
fuzzy
a terrible lion up your arse, yeah. Isn't it, I think?
Absolutely. Good. Nice one. Sid, thank you very much indeed. Now, Barry, Bayern Basel, wasn't that what you were itching to talk about back at the start of this show?
Well, not really, no? Because I noticed in my page of notes the big white expanse of space on
all right,
the
let me help you out.
I know Basel go into the game with a one-goal lead from the first leg.
Correct. Do you know what Bayern did this weekend?
No.
Yes, they beat Hoffenheim
7-1.
7-1. And was 7-0 up after an hour.
Trouble with by Gomez, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm. I'd say Basel might be in some trouble here.
Well, I would write them off at my peril or anyone else's peril. I haven't seen much of them this season, but the two or three games I have seen them play, they've been very, very impressive. Bayern Munich are second in the Bundesliga, but they're far from infallible.
Well, and that's true.
Yeah, they'd have the work cut out for them to win the game, I suspect. Yeah.
Basel well organised, etc. Now, Ligue 1.
Ligue 1.
Yeah, because, you know, we had a major shot last week with Lyon getting knocked out by Apple Nicosia.
Yeah, after a French side capitulating in the knockout stages of the Champions League.
I was surprised
it was
as well.
A huge surprise.
Right.
Yeah, it was probably, I mean, it was one of the most horrible games I've seen in a very, very long time.
What's
it
that,
was then? Painful. Oh, wow. Come on, it was painful to watch. It was painful to watch. They could have scored in the first leg. They could have scored far more than the one goal. They were happy with that. Then even playing as badly as they did, they still could have scored one goal and gone through. It's absolutely shocking. It was obvious that some of the Lyon players have been caught on, have basically been holding the team since the beginning of the season, are showing signs of physical decline.
Mm.
Perhaps thought that they could take that game a little bit more easily because they had a big league game after that, which, by the way, they've won and quite convincingly.
That was Lille, is that right?
Yeah, they beat Lille 2-1, and believe me, they could have won by more than that. But it was shocking. I mean, key players like Lisandro Gomez and Michel Bastos were a shadow of themselves.
Right.
So, no, it went down pretty badly in France, I can tell you
so
that.
So the last French hope in the Champions League is Olympique Marseille,
yeah,
who have a one-goal lead from the match at the Velodrome against Inter, and they play at the San Siro.
One-nil lead. Yeah.
One-nil lead.
Score no away from home, which is very important, of course. And Inter is doing a little bit better. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. But Marseille had their fourth consecutive league defeat, and at Ajaccio. That's not good at all. It's a very depressing place to be at the moment. But four defeats on the trot and having deserved every single one of them. André Ayew will be back. Gignac will be back for the game against Inter. And people are saying, well, maybe the performance at Ajaccio was so poor because Marseille is so, you know, one-track mind, basically. They're thinking about this Inter game more than anything. But their home form in the league has been abysmal.
Four defeats in a row. They haven't scored in any of them. They're taking on an Inter team that's just won its first game in nine.
Yeah.
Recently went five games without scoring.
So we're going to have a 4-2
clearly
goal fest.
But as you say, Inter doing a bit better. They're now on that one game winning streak. They got their first victory since January, and they had to wait until I think the 87th minute before they could put the ball in the net against Chievo at the weekend. So emotional was Claudio Ranieri in seeing the fruits of his labours. This was the explanation. He was all misty-eyed on the sideline. He seemed to be welling up when they finally got the win. And it was explained that he was like a labourer who after months of working on the circuits of a building, finally sees some light appear. Mm. I like that metaphor. Anyway, so, well, there you go. So the Wesley Sneijder back in the side and at the heart of things for Inter this weekend. So, yeah, it's an interesting game, that one.
One thing you could say, Marseille are a team which is normally very hard to break down.
Oh.
And that's When they are at their best, which isn't great, but when they are at their best, they are very, very hard to break down, as I think, you know, Manchester United fans will remember, as Arsenal fans will remember as well. They don't present much of a threat up front anymore. I don't think the goal fest is going to happen. But there are weird things happening there. I mean, everybody's talking. The chairman, Vincent Labrune, is talking. Mr. Dreyfus' widow is saying that she's going to put a lot of money in the club. The fight between José Anigo, the sports director, and Didier Deschamps shows no sign of abating. It's just a terrible situation at Marseille.
Oh, dear.
And to think this is a club which, you know, two seasons ago was you know, won the double.
Yeah. What about Cuddly Carlo at PSG? How's he doing?
Well, he did all right over the weekend. It was complicated. They won, you know, they played with 10 men for a long time after a murder attempt by Momo Sissoko on one of the Dijon players. It was really, really shocking.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things, you go for the ball, studs first, you make absolutely sure you get the ankle or the top of the foot before you get the ball, and really maximum weight. That hurt. They won at a Dijon team, which is, I would say, with the French Swansea in terms of the way they play a very expansive game, a breath of fresh air. Mm. They've got some very decent players, like Benjamin Cornier, for example, an outsider for Laurent Blanc's 23. Well, very big outsider, that is. And they won in the 90th minute. An interesting stat about PSG, which shows that they've got some resilience, is that it's the seventh time they've scored the decisive goal after the 90th minute this season in the league, which is pretty remarkable.
That is remarkable. If Sean Inger was here, he'd say they mustered a good performance against Dijon, but he's not.
Yes, they cut the mustard. Yes.
So there you go. Well, that's nice. And so they're top of the league, PSG.
They're top of the league, but just 1 point ahead of Montpellier, who carry on doing their incredible... Allez. I mean, their incredible streaks of result at home.
Right.
36 points out of 42.
Right.
Which is not bad. And they've scored in all their games but two in the league this season. That's absolutely remarkable.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Now...
With Olivier Giroud scoring again, by the way.
He did again?
Yeah.
Has crazy.
To. Sir Alex Ferguson, was that... The Leon Lille game on Saturday night.
Yeah, he was. Yeah,
presumably to run the rule over
Eden Hazard.
Eden Hazard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the camera cut to him after one of the goals, and he was.
Was he crying?
No, he was yawning. And then at halftime, some reporter asked Eden Hazard if he knew Fergie was in the crowd and that he'd been yawning, and he said, "No, I didn't know he was there, but maybe he was tired."
And by the way, it is now customary when we say Lille to give news of Joe Cole.
Oh, yeah, Joe Cole.
Yeah, he played.
Uh-huh.
He was pretty abysmal.
Oh.
Yeah. He really? Had one of his rare bad performances, and was actually substituted. And I think L'Equipe gave him a 3 out of 10 for his performance, which was not undeserved. But right. This is just a hitch in otherwise what is
everyone
a beautiful, loving relationship.
Yeah. Well, he won't be at Lille next year. Where will he be, Joe Cole? I mean, he's on loan.
Oh,
from
Liverpool.
Yeah, he'll go back there. Yeah, okay.
Liverpool could probably do with him.
Yes.
Now, let's finish off, hey, by doing a bit on Serie A.
We don't talk about Suarez and the interview he gave to Canal Plus quickly.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, let's talk about Suarez and the
interview. Just to put the story to bed, because it was absolutely ridiculous. Suddenly it was, I mean, last night people got very excited saying, well, Luis Suarez has talked to Canal Plus French television, and the quotes started to circulate. And basically, when you read the quotes, Suarez is out of Liverpool going to PSG, and that's nonsense, because what they had done, this program, very populist program, which is broadcast on Sunday on Canal Plus, they did a subject about Lugano, which is a fair enough subject, because this guy is Mr. Football in Uruguay, you know, went to the semifinals of the World Cup, captain of the team that won the Copa America, and he's playing one game out of three for PSG. So people wonder, what is the mystery behind Lugano? So they spoke to some of his friends, and they spoke to Edinson Cavani, and they spoke to Luis Suarez. And as it happens in those sort of things, both Cavani and Suarez went out in defense of Lugano, whom they respect, and they have an awful lot of respect for him, obviously, to the extent that they said, well, we would love to play in the same club as he does. And of course, the reporters being French, they asked, well, so would you play for PSG? And Luis Suarez said, I play for PSG as I would play for any big club. And suddenly it becomes, oh, I'm going to play for PSG. So that's absolutely ridiculous. Mm.
Although I think if you're a player and somebody asks you that question, you probably have enough media training to know that if you say that.
Well, I don't think Luis Suarez has got an awful lot of media training, and he's received media training in the past. I don't think it has made a deep impression over him, as past events have shown us.
Yeah, fair
and
point.
And if you're being trained by the PR department at Liverpool, it's probably fair to say you need to be completely... rebooted.
what's awful? I don't understand that. I mean, we're all complaining all the time that players don't say what they really think. You just say something very, you know, polite. He wanted to support his teammate, and that's about it.
In the last 15 years or so, the extent to which quotes are twisted is just embarrassing. It's shameful. And by people who should know better, I mean, it's easy to say certain institutions are guilty, but I think it's pretty widespread these days.
Right. The Guardian, for example. Does it happen at The Guardian?
It would never happen at The Guardian, James. Right. You know that.
But other places?
I couldn't name them. But.
All right, then. Okay. Now, let's finish off by touching on it, because Philippe's very keen to talk about Serie A, and he's our guest. So What are we going to talk about here? I mentioned Cagliari firing Ballardini after getting thumped by Napoli. At the top of the table, Milan are 4 points clear after an Ibrahimovic-inspired victory. How often we heard that, except in the Champions League, over, who did they play? Lecce at San Siro. And that put them 4 points clear because Juve drew and the two teams below them, Lazio and Udinese, both lost. Juve was so irate at what they felt was bad refereeing in their 0-0 draw at Genoa. There was a goal, iffy offside call on what would have been their, you know, match-winning goal that went against them, and that they called a press silence. They're not going to talk to the media now in protest at the referees. So
I mean, Juve, you look at the table, it's absolutely extraordinary what's happening there. You look at them, they still haven't lost a single game in Serie A. They've drawn 14. Apparently, they're getting close to the all-time record in Serie A, which is Mantova, isn't it?
Well, the example I would give here is Perugia.
Perugia?
Yeah, in 1978, Perugia went the entire season unbeaten, but still missed out on the title.
Didn't they only win 11 out of 30? I think probably.
Or Renato Curi, the heart that. But anyway, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, I was going to mention Perugia. Oh, yeah. Extraordinary story. A small.
It could yet happen. But six draws in the last seven, and Milan are 4 points clear. Not all rosy in the Rossoneri camp, though, because Ibrahimovic, there's a little bit of tension still simmering away there after his. He was very disappointed with Milan's performances, I think most of the club would have been, at the Emirates. And he had an explanation for it. He was played out of position. I mean, he was up front, but he wasn't quite. And there was something about the way that Allegri used him as a front three, but not the way he likes a front three. This weekend, it was a front three, but in a way that he found appealing. And he dutifully scored. He set up Bernoccherino with a brilliant assist and then a lovely goal to make it 2-0. And afterwards, an interviewer said, so, you know, are you going to be a bit happier with the manager this time? And he kind of stared her down and said, what are you talking about? And they said, she said, oh, you weren't happy. Who told you I wasn't happy? And anyway, so that interview finishes. And then he starts doing another interview, but the reporter's still there. Ibra sees this on live Italian TV. He says, what the f*** are you looking at? And then threw his headband at her. Thwack.
That tells you all you need to know about modern football,
doesn't it?
A player throwing his hairband at somebody because he's angry with...
There was a suggestion, and this is unconfirmed, so I probably shouldn't even mention it, because it would be very disappointing were it to be true, but that he said to her, go home and do some cooking.
And bring your sister as well.
Bring your sister. But I don't know if that's true. That was one...
Well, you apparently called her later on to apologise.
There was a clarificatory phone call to explain the misunderstanding. So that's good. That's all sorted then. I will just mention, I say not Udinese, who the wheels are falling off in a very major way. They got beaten by Novara, who are the penultimate team in Serie A. Novara was their first win in about a decade. And the kind of angle here, which is the reason I mention it, unless you're a Novara fan, which, well done, chaps, is the fact that this was the return of Attilio Tessa. Now, Tessa is another of these examples of a manager who got fired about six games ago. They brought in this fellow, Emiliano Mondonico, who you probably remember from the, you know, what some would call the glory days of Serie A. He took Torino all the way to third. He UEFA
by
Cup
glory
and all
days
that.
Of Serie A, do you mean
the ones
your
I was
day?
In, yeah. No, when there was, you know, Hulid, Van Basten,
I don't think
that,
anyone
Maradona.
Would disagree, Jim.
Oh, thanks. But anyway, so they brought back Mondonico. The key thing about Mondonico is that he'd been everywhere, but he'd also been in hospital a lot. He had a 5-kilogram tumour removed from his stomach, which he managed to beat. And then this was his first job back. And when he came in, there was all this feel-good interviews about, oh, I feel life is beginning for me again. And 6 weeks later, he's been binned by a cruel Novara. Although, to be fair, the fans had never wanted them to get rid of Attilio Tessa in the first place because he'd won them back-to-back promotions. Anyways, back there now. So there you go.
Yeah. One more thing about Serie A.
Yeah. Only one?
Yeah, only one. But it's because of it's a player that I absolutely I had a lot of time for when he was in England. One of those players, when you see him, just the first 5-10 seconds, you think these guys really got something special.
Really?
Fabio Borini.
Right.
Absolutely. And I don't know, for some reason, I've seen almost every minute that Borini has played for Chelsea's first team, and I've never understood where they let him go. And there you go. 7 games, 7 goals for Roma. Yeah. Again, the decisive goal yesterday. Super talent.
A 1-0 win for Roma at Palermo, which puts their manager, once again, in a slightly precarious position. But it's interesting, and he's in the Italian national team. Now, when I was talking about this yesterday with
the ones who got away, Giuseppe Rossi is another one.
Right, but it's interesting, he went to Parma, and then Parma loaned him to Roma, and you wonder why they didn't hang on to him. But the informed opinion seemed to be Barini, it's 7 goals in 7 games, and the funny thing is he's not actually that good, but you really like him.
I really like him, and I always liked him. He's one of those players, I don't know, he's got a presence about him, and it's probably something that you feel more, especially at Stamford Bridge, you're very, very close to the pitch, and he used to play on the right-hand side normally. Right. So you could see what he was like, the way he was looking at the game around him, the way he was receiving the ball, distributing it. So there was a real brain at work and two very good feet.
Tell you who else has got presents about him. Barry, it's his birthday.
Do you know how many presents I've got? None.
Yet.
Not one.
Yeah, but, you know.
Sid sang you happy birthday
in
Spanish.
Yeah, and gave you that lovely mental image.
Joyeux anniversaire.
There you go. And does it just keep going? No, so French does change the lyrics. There you go.
Barry.
Well, on this special, special day, then, that's it for Football Weekly. We'll be back on Thursday. In the meantime, many thanks to guest producer Ian, to Philippe, to Rob Smythe, and to Barry Glendedding. And have a lovely week, everyone. We'll speak to you again on Thursday.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/freedownload to find out more.